For the past 25 years, Bordeaux Index has been relentless in our focus on changing the fine wine market for collectors and investors. Today, we are the largest seller of fine wine and spirits globally. Bordeaux Index, join us and visit bordeauxindex.com.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and today my guest is the Palestinian chef and hotelier Fadi Katan. Fadi grew up in Bethlehem, where he inherited a love of food early on from his two grandmothers. He trained in Paris as a classical chef before returning to his native country to open Fadwa on the occupied West Bank. Influenced by the ever-changing political situation in Palestine, his new restaurant, Akoub, has recently opened in Notting Hill, serving a menu inspired by the different regions of Palestine. Fadi, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Fadi, as listeners will know, we always start this podcast at the same place, which is by asking, what are your earliest memories of food?
My earliest memory is one that was actually told to me, and I have vague recollections, because you know how memory works. When somebody suggests something, you think you remember it. And it seems as a very, very young child, I was being fed some cereal-based thing that was tasteless. And then my mother decided to try feeding me the meat filling of something called sfiha, which is a dough pastry that has meat and tahini in it. And it seems I loved it, and I refused to eat cereal after that. So that's the first memory. It's an induced memory.
And what were mealtimes like for your family?
So mealtimes in my family, my father's a businessman who at the time traveled a lot. And for him, breakfast was sacred. And breakfast was combining both his natural identity and his cultural identity, i.e. my father is Palestinian, but he's also British. So breakfast meant labneh, za'atar, olive oil, Nablusi cheese, and eggs and bacon.
So that was the nod to the British.
That was the ritual every morning. And of course, when we came back from school, my mother would always have fantastic Palestinian meals waiting for us.
And what are the kind of classic Palestinian dishes that your mother would have been cooking?
Mansaf, which is rice, hydrated yogurt, and lamb that's slow cooked in it, or stuffed vine leaves and courgettes, or... We had a few family recipes, one of them called Rosto Mariam, which means Mariam's roast. And it's because my great-grandmother was called Mariam. And apparently she came up with this roast recipe that was quite heavy on bay leaves. But we enjoyed it very much. And she finished it with garlic and a bit of chili. So imagine giving this to a kid. But then there was another rhythm in our meals. My parents and my maternal grandparents entertained a lot. So very often in the evenings, we'd be having guests over for dinners. And that is where I started having that joy and pleasure of hospitality. Because it was this vibe across the house, whether it's, again, my grandparents or my parents, where you're getting the silverware out, you're making sure you have the right tablecloths. Both my mother and my late grandmother were very picky on using starch in ironing, and I think I'm one of the few people that still does use real starch to iron my tablecloths.
Oh. And how about learning to cook? Where did that process begin? Was that when you were a child or a bit older?
In my grandmother Julia's home, so my mother's mother, I think the first memory I really have is cracking eggs for breakfast, for fried eggs in ghee with sumac on top, and then slowly being introduced to more and more of her cuisine, sometimes to the dismay of my mother, because then I'd try and replicate the recipes in the evening at my parents' house. And let's say I wasn't very good at not using all the pots in the house to do one simple recipe.
I know that style of cooking. And what about school food? What's school food like? Was it Bethlehem where you grew up?
So I grew up in Bethlehem, but I went to the French school in Jerusalem.
Right. And what was school food like there?
There was no school food.
Ah, so what were you eating for lunch?
There was no school food. We'd go with our little sandwiches from home. My favorite was always a little Khmer bread, which is called pita here, with olive oil and za'atar, or with labneh, olive oil, and za'atar. I mean, that is... It was my favorite, let's say it was my favorite most of the year when we hit the summer month and it was warm. It was my least favorite because double fermented labneh is not really a great thing in a sandwich.
No, I can imagine. And after school, you then moved to Paris. What took you to Paris and what were your sort of first impressions of food in Paris at that point?
So on my mother's side, my grandfather, Palestinian grandfather, but he spent his childhood in France. And we were really brought up with this love of France and French cuisine and French literature and arts. So I did spend a lot of my childhood holidays in France. And going to Paris to study wasn't very much something bizarre. It was rather a natural way of going forward, except that I come from a business family. And when I told my parents I wanted to study hospitality and cooking, they somehow looked at me strangely and said no. So we made a deal, because that's something I think you learn very quickly in a trading family, is you learn to negotiate. And our negotiation was I would do my BA in international business and then be able to do a master's in anything I wanted. Paris was great doing my BA because I chose the route of facility. And I didn't do it at a French university, but I did it at the American University of Paris, where I negotiated an equivalence to my French baccalauréat. So I actually did my BA in a year and a half less. And I spent most of the time trying the restaurants in Paris.
And you were training in the presumably classical French style. What was that like?
So that was when I did my master's. I trained at the Institut Vatel in Paris, which was very classical. We actually had a training restaurant at the university where we served three set menus every night, very classical. There's things that I still enjoy, maybe for their nostalgia, but I very much enjoy a salad course after your main course and a cheese course and a dessert course. And I think a digestif is an essential end of a meal. I think that really comes from both my childhood and the university. What was really eye-opening at the time in this classical training was that in Palestine, at that time, the restaurant scene was a restaurant scene that was going very fast forward towards globalized, standardized meals. And so you were seeing things like the horrible fettuccine Alfredo puppet's nose and so forth. And at school in Paris, we were celebrating the provenance of produce. We were celebrating the local terroirs. And that by itself was quite eye-opening because I kept comparing and saying, but why are we not doing this in Palestine? And that's what moved me years later to open Fauda in Bethlehem.
And what was it like starting a restaurant in Palestine?
People thought I was a nutcase because Fauda means chaos. And the reason it's called chaos is because there's no menu at Fauda. So we only work on pre-bookings, and what is cooked in Fauda is what I find at the farmer's market that day. And coming to Bethlehem, where you have to imagine the scene in Bethlehem. So Bethlehem mainly has massive pilgrimage tourism, and people come in on a coach. They're fed quite an inexpensive meal, not necessarily a good meal, and then they're taken out of the city. Some people spend a few nights, one or two nights as pilgrims. And for the locals, the food was either the street food, so falafel, shawarma, hummus, or the classic mezes and grilled meats. But then all the rest was foreign. All the rest was burger joints and pseudo-Italian cuisine and what have you, which weren't very much respectful of the local terroir. And when we started, and I went up to the farmers and started buying things, they knew me because they know my mother, they knew my grandmother. But for them, the idea was like, wait, you're going to really cook with those local herbs? You're going to have foreigners taste that? And one of them, which is the dried fermented yogurt, the Laban Jamid, which we use today at Akub, doing Mansaf, has quite a particular taste. And I think that's one of my victories, where I actually convinced the producer that we're using Laban Jamid and that it's not a repulsive taste. It's rather very close to an aged dry cheese in other cultures. But it was really the celebration In the beginning, the challenges I had were, so the restaurant is in a building that dates from 1736, and it's in the heart of the old city. It's not really accessible by car. You need to walk a bit. In our local culture, people today are no more walking, even though we were very much a walking society. So it was very challenging when I was getting bookings and people were saying, oh, where can I park my car? And I was like, well, you can't. You're going to walk to the restaurant. But also creating a team, as most people in Palestine were not formally trained. And there was this strange guy telling them, tables need a molleton and then two white tablecloths. And you'll starch them once they're on the table. Or things like, you're going to peel the peas. But as in peel the little skin on the peas. I thought it took quite a bit of time to get a team that was coherent. But that's also, I think, a success. Most people that work in Fawda, that worked in Fawda, because we did close down with COVID and we haven't reopened yet, most people didn't even come from formal training. My sous chef in Bethlehem is somebody who started, because we had guest rooms, who started off as a housekeeper. And then she showed interest in the kitchen and ended up being the sous chef. And the head waiter was somebody who'd never carried a tray before working with us. And I think that's a bit doing a business in places like Palestine is there's such a rewarding feeling as a team when you share those, the knowledge and the privilege that you've had to have studied and worked abroad with a community that matters.
And Fadi, I suppose some people listening will probably associate the region where you work or were working with the politics of the region. I mean, does that have an influence on the way you cook and the way you run a restaurant, or can you keep them separate?
Of course. What you have to realise, Bethlehem as a city has a 12-metre high wall that was built by the Israeli authorities illegally against international law inside the city, and it encroaches inside Bethlehem itself. So that makes the historic twinning of Jerusalem and Bethlehem more difficult, and people who are staying in Jerusalem have less access to Bethlehem. But also, on the lands of the city of Bethlehem, there are 23 illegal Israeli settlements that have been built that are connected to Jerusalem with highways that were built, again, illegally on stolen Palestinian land. And that has disconnected a lot of the villages around Bethlehem to the city of Bethlehem. Therefore, the arrival of produce is very complicated. We've seen a lot of farmers choose not to come to the city anymore, and they end up either joining forces with other farmers from their village and having one person come in with all the different crop. What it also means is all our water aquifers, so all natural water in the region of Bethlehem is today controlled by the Israeli authorities, and it's sold to us at three times more or less the price it's sold to an Israeli settler. In summer, we don't have running water. And I understand for somebody living in London, it may sound totally absurd. Imagine that Thames water from that tube that comes into your house, you spend a month and a half where you don't have water. So running a restaurant like this wasn't always easy. We've had times where we had to purchase water and have, I mean, as I was saying earlier, we don't have car access, so we had to close down roads, get a water tank that would connect through meters and meters of pipes to feed the restaurant in water. Or sometimes the farmers I work with would say, I'll be there in half an hour, I have some interesting crop. And they wouldn't show up because the Israelis had put a checkpoint on the way and we'd have to improvise.
Gosh, it sounds very difficult at times.
But look, it has such a meaning that it's worth it. And I'd do it over and over again.
And what about the actual food? I mean, do the politics of the region feed into that? Well, I know there was some controversy around the inclusion of non-halal meats in your restaurant. How do you approach that aspect of it?
Okay, so for me, that is not political. That is, in Palestine, at Fawda, I cooked both. I mean, not both. I cooked lamb and beef and pork, depending on what was there that day. And just like any food restriction, whether it's based on faith or personal choice or dietary condition, I mean, whatever, we're there to cater for that. And people would be able to have a nice meal, you know, without meat if that day I was cooking pork, or without shellfish if they were of Jewish faith, or it's beyond the... And actually, I never understood the controversy that happened here, because we sell alcohol. In Bethlehem, I sell, and I proudly sell Palestinian wines and arak, and wine is one of the oldest... I mean, Palestine is one of the oldest countries to have produced wine. I don't see where people make a controversy out of something that is not there. Yes, the meat we use in Akku today is not halal, but it's not because I chose not to cook halal. It's because I chose sustainable, small, responsible, quality farming. And the butchers we work with, who in turn work with a few farms in the UK that have fabulous meat, don't have halal meat.
And tell us about what brought you to London and why you've opened a Palestinian-influenced restaurant in London. Did you see a gap in the market?
Well, look, the initial reason was a few years ago I got a call from a lady called Rasha Khoury, who's originally Palestinian, and I knew her father well. And she said, what do you think of a Palestinian restaurant in London? And we've partnered since then, and we're co-founders of Akub, and then reached out to investors. So we have a varied investment platform who owns Akub. And yes, definitely, we saw a big market gap in London. But also, I worked in London 22 years ago, 23 years ago. I worked for a few months at the Intercontinental at Hyde Park Corner, which had a fabulous restaurant at the time called the Soufflé, which was very, very classic. And if you remember, 25 years ago in London, you didn't have many options to eat very well. And London's seen a revolution that's very admirable in the food scene. And I would say the most admirable of it is how British chefs have gone back to celebrate local produce, because there are fantastic produce here. It's such a joy to work with the dairy, the meat, the herbs, the vegetables, the fish that we're getting here that's all locally sourced, because those produce are fantastic. And I saw in that, between the gap and the opportunity that we identified with Russia, and then the quality of the produce, the curiosity of people, I really saw that there was a potential there. And luckily, since we've opened, we've been fully booked every night.
That's great. That's brilliant news. And Fanny, for you, when you're cooking for yourself at home, what for you is comfort food? What do you like to cook away from the restaurant?
It all depends. So I have a soft spot for slow-cooked meats. So when I'm cooking at home in Bethlehem, I very often end up at my butcher. I mean, I think my butcher is most probably my best friend, or practically. I end up there and end up going home with quite a bit of lamb. But then there's somebody else who's very important. And it's a lady who's at the entrance of the market in Bethlehem called Nabil. She comes from a village south of Bethlehem. And she comes with both grown and foraged herbs and vegetables. And she would very often be the one deciding what I'm cooking, because depending on what she has, I would cook that. I do have a very soft spot for something called mulukhiya. Mulukhiya is, in English, is called jute mallow. And it's a quite special leaf that's cooked in a stew a bit across between Egypt, Palestine, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. It's cooked differently, but it's a stew with meat or chicken served with rice. I think that would be my go-to recipe very often at home.
And Fanny, do you have a sweet tooth? Do you like pudding? What are the kind of classic Palestinian puddings?
Who doesn't like sweets?
You say that, but lots of people come on this podcast and tell us they don't.
I'll even tell you a secret. I don't sleep much, and very often at 2:30, 3 in the morning, I will have a coffee, dark chocolate, and a cigarette, and then go back to bed. But classic Palestinian puddings are... So now that Ramadan has started, I very much like something called qatayef. Qatayef are little pancakes that are usually done to celebrate Ramadan, but you can get them all year round. And they're stuffed with a salty cheese, so Nablusi cheese that has been de-salted, but it still has a bit of salt. And then they're either deep-fried or baked. And on top of them, you add a bit of syrup with either rose water or orange blossom water. In Bethlehem, I think it's fantastic because the best qatayef maker is actually a Christian. And it's a very powerful message of how we're all Palestinians with all of our faiths. I love qatayef, and I think I can eat a lot of qatayef. The ones with cheese, not the ones with walnut. I know that the iconic Palestinian dessert is knafa. The knafa from Nablus is exceptional. It's again that same cheese, a bit of vermicelli, or rubbed vermicelli on top and syrup to finish. The other one I really like is something called awama, which is basically a little beignet that's deep fried. The dough is a basic beignet dough. It has a bit of orange blossom and it's deep fried. And then again, sticky. I love puddings. I could go on and on about
clearly. And I suppose actually pudding is something that does, as you say, transcend religion, doesn't it? Most people have a sweet tooth. And Fanny, just finally to finish on, we always like to ask our guests, what would be your desert island meal? What would be your ultimate meal?
Okay, how many courses do I get?
You can have as many courses as you like.
Okay, so do we have another hour to record this podcast?
Okay, let's limit it to three. Would you start with three pudding?
I would start with oysters. I think I must have been the youngest human being to have oysters. Must have been 2 years old. And I'm obsessed with oysters. But of course, raw oysters. I think it's a crime to cook an oyster. I cannot even imagine a cooked oyster. But raw oysters. Then I would have a Palestinian mansaf. Or musakhan. So mansaf is the rice, the yogurt, the lamb, or the musakhan, which is this fantastic bread. Sumac, like onions confit in sumac, grilled chicken, a lot of olive oil. So either or. And then the pudding is tricky. Can I have four courses? Can I have cheeses before I have my pudding?
You can. Yeah, I'm not going to deny you cheese.
Great. So I'll have a big fat Mont d'Or, which I'll eat with a spoon.
good choice. Very good choice.
And then I'll have a very nice Palestinian kunafa.
Delicious. Well, Fadi, thank you very much for joining Table Talk today. And Fadi's new restaurant, Akoub, is in Notting Hill. And if you'd like to book a place, you can either call the restaurant or contact them via Instagram.